Lack of a balance impedes success. The greater the imbalance, the more sure the failure. This morning I'd like to expand that a bit. Exercising loving firmness. I'm going to start with a diagram taken from Dr. Bruce Wilkinson's idea that he gives. He talks about teacher orientation. Three different ways that teachers major in and are the best in actually getting to the student. Some teachers greatly enjoy the subject. That's their strong point. They get to the student through the subject. Other teachers enjoy the student so much they go directly to the students. Other teachers enjoy the style. They enjoy the dynamics of teaching. They enjoy the process of teaching, and they go through that to get to the student. I'm suggesting that we need a proper balance of them all. Let me read for you, so that you may figure out which one you are. Three paragraphs, one for each one. Subject oriented. I love the content. I almost always have two or three times more material prepared than I need to, and frequently find myself hurrying at the end of class to finish on time. I enjoy explaining things and want my class to have a thorough understanding. I love lists of material, have a strong need to know the facts myself, and like to research in books and commentaries. Sometimes I have to watch that I don't let the material get too complex for the average student in my class. That was a subject-oriented teacher. Here's a student-oriented teacher. I love my students. I feel more like they're my friends than my students. I'm interested in each of them and enjoy being with them in and out of class. I love to share stories from my own life and family and feel that my students are like my extended family. Sometimes I have to watch that our sharing and discussions don't stray from the subject too long, but I just want to be as much help to them as possible. That was the student-oriented teacher. Now the style-oriented. I love what takes place during the process of teaching and learning. I love seeing the electricity of a class that is alive, with the students hanging on to every word. I like to use my creativity in the classroom and always find myself trying new things to keep the class exciting and moving. The students enjoy what I do in class because it's never boring. Sometimes I might get a little carried away in my creative attempts to keep the material fresh and alive, but the students always seem to love the spontaneity and variety. I love to teach and can't wait for class to begin. The larger the class, the better I love it. I don't know which ones you identify with the most closely. Let me show you, however, what an imbalance will do. For the subject-oriented teacher, if he is primarily and only subject-oriented, and that is the only way that if he's imbalanced in that area, that is his strong point, and he has weakened the others. He might be boring. He loves to lecture. He loves information. He might not feel for the students like he ought to. He feels he has a passion for the content. He demands good work. He makes the students feel intimidated. They may feel that he is so smart, he's just way out above me. And I'm scared to ask him a question because I know he's going to think I'm stupid. So he actually may lose a touch with the students. If this is his only way of getting to the student. Let's go to the student-oriented teacher. If he is only student-oriented, he will probably be disorderly. He'll be behind in his work. He'll be behind schedule. He's spending so much time with his students Students are more important than subject. He's probably undisciplined himself. He has undisciplined students. He ends up being a people pleaser. Now, for the style-oriented teacher, he may talk too much. He might get too loud. He gets carried away. He's the type of person that's always updating his computers and his PowerPoint presentations, and he's spending a lot of time in the actual process, all the gadgets. He's up to date on all the gadgets. Nothing essentially wrong with that. However, he spends a lot of time in that, and he actually relies on that. He actually might pretend to know. You've probably heard of the preacher who was substituting for some other preacher on the spur of the moment, and he was following the other preacher's sermon notes, and he came to a point where the original preacher was going to, where he had penciled in weak point, shout. He was going to make up for a lack of content with a spectacular delivery. Well, the techniques or the style-oriented teacher might do that. He may pretend that he knows more than he really does. You can only get along on pretense and charm for so long. Then things will break down. I'm suggesting, though, that we need to know our subjects. We need to know our students. We need to know how to teach. We need a balance in all. Find yourself, see where you are, understand your strengths, understand your weaknesses. Capitalize on your strengths and work on your weaknesses. If you're subject-oriented, you realize that, you know, I really need to spend more time getting to know my students. You already know your subject matter good enough. Of course, you need to continue studying. You need to stay fresh. If you're student-oriented and you sense this problem with getting off subject and you start talking about whatever else, understand that and understand you need to work some more structure and discipline into your classroom. We need to be balanced. The lack of balance impedes success. The greater the imbalance, the more sure the failure. Psalm chapter 85 and verse 10 says this: mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. John 1:14 says this: and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Sometimes in our human way of thinking, we may think that grace and truth, we may think of those two as opposing forces, as opposing contradictory terms. It's either one or the other. In fact, one teacher told me once that teachers are either liars or lawyers, one or the two. And you'll understand when you're grading math lessons what I mean or what he meant. Here's a student that you can see in his work that he actually worked it correctly, but when he came up to write his answer in the blank, he copied it incorrectly. What do you do? You're going to be a liar? You're going to be a lawyer? I don't quite like those terms. I think that we can be full of grace and truth. So using grace today as the single word for the whole concept, the whole idea of showing mercy and love and gentleness and kindness, and using truth today as a single word term for the idea of justice, righteousness, upholding a standard, holiness. How can we be full of both? let me explain something further. We may think that they're contradictory. They're not contradictory. In fact, you can't have one without the other. The absence of truth negates the need for grace totally. If there is no standard of truth, there's nothing to be held to. By virtue of that, there is no need for grace. Without the standard of truth to be held up to, there's no need for mercy to pardon when we can't reach it. There's no need for the divine enablement of God's grace to help us, to bring us to the satisfaction of meeting the requirement. Grace, by its own definition, indicates the existence of a standard of justice. If there is no standard of justice, there's no need for grace. I can do what I want to, and there's absolutely no need for grace. Reminds me of Laura Ingalls' response when she was asked whether she liked Almanzo or his horses. She said, anybody know what she said? She said, well, now she really liked his horses. It seemed almost like, in fact, some people were thinking that she liked his horses better than him. She said, well, I can't have one without the other. You can't have grace without truth. You can't have truth without grace. We in our humanity, we in our frailty, in failing to see the big picture, oftentimes major on one in an imbalanced way. And that imbalance, I'm suggesting, is very detrimental. Let me try to give you a picture of this. The teacher that is strong on truth and weak on grace, he maintains order with a rod of iron. He's stiff, he's firm, he's right, he's unsmiling, he's in control, everyone knows it. You can hear a needle drop. Subjects are taught as plain bare truths. Here it is. You need to get it. Wrong is punished firmly and swiftly. Principles are valued. Now, there's nothing wrong with these in and of themselves, by themselves. He will not compromise. He's strong. He demands perfection. He makes the students suffer for wrong. What happens, though, is that the students fear the teacher. Let's go to the other side. The teacher that's strong on grace and weak on truth, he hopes that everyone feels good. He doesn't really like the rod of iron. He'd rather make them feel like being good and therefore feel good. Learning is made to be fun. Right is encouraged. Wrong is overlooked. People are valued above principles. Students are helped to achieve their best, or what they deem to be their best. This teacher will go the second mile. He overlooks requirements. He's willing to suffer for the students, in fact. Problem is, by the end of the year, the students disrespect him. They fear the strong on truth teacher, weak on grace. They disrespect the strong on grace and weak on truth teacher. Let's see how we can marry the two. The teacher maintains order with a loving, firm hand. You've heard the idea of an iron hand and a velvet glove. That's what we're talking about. an iron hand in a velvet glove. The touch is soft. The atmosphere is right. The principle is unmovable. It's strong. It's firm. But the touch, the application is soft. It's approachable. Misbehavior and wrongs are not overlooked, but are punished with the good of the child in mind. Punishment is never abusive, but is corrective. And the child knows that he is loved. The child understands that this is for my good. It's not just because the teacher was mad that I got spanked. It's because the teacher loves me, he cares about me, and he loves me enough to spank me or punish in any other way. This teacher motivates his students to achieve their maximum potential. He finds their strong points and weak points and inspires them to succeed from where they are. Probably some 30 years ago, at least that was the first I heard it, cool phrase came into being. And this was a phrase that he accepted me just as I am. That was when the rise of self-acceptance was all, that was coming. He accepted me just as I am. Somebody added to it, but loved me too much to leave me there or to let me remain that way. That's what we're talking about. We're talking adding that, marrying the two together. The loving just as you are, but loving too much to allow somebody to remain that way. This teacher will not compromise on truth, yet he is willing to bend over backwards for his students. Uncompromising on truth, willing to go the second mile. The teacher is respected and loved by his students. He loves the child, and he disciplines out the mischief in the child. This is the balance that we want to achieve. There needs to be a pull and a push. I like bean burritos. Somebody needs to invent a word for the proper amount of, for the relationship between, after you take about the third bite, if you're not careful, while you get the bottom of the burrito just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Somebody needs to invent a word for the correct amount of suction that you put on the thing with your mouth and the correct amount of squeeze with your hand to make the burrito come out even. It's the correct pull and the correct push. That's what I'm talking about. There's a pull and a push. There are punishments and there are rewards. We need to be balanced in those. We naturally tend to go toward forgetting the rewards, going for the punishment. We expect a child to do what's right. Since it's the expected, we don't notice it. We notice, however, when he does wrong. That comes pretty naturally to all of us. I'm suggesting that we need to be careful. We need to be balanced in this. We need to be aware that we need some pull in front of the student. We need to dangle the carrot out in front of the donkey. We need to pull him forward. And we need to push him sometimes. Scolding and compliments. Personally, I forget the compliments because if they do what's right, that's what they ought to do anyhow. But no. Notice when they do right. Notice what they do when they do right. Somebody said, I don't remember who it was, that he could go about a month off of one good compliment. Thereby, he's indicating that they are scarce. I think it was Bill Gothard that came up with this idea that when you give any negative criticism, you need to use the sandwich approach. That's what he said. You tell them something good about them, you tell them something you appreciate about them, then you tell them what the problem is, and then you come again with something that you appreciate about him. Somebody else added to that. They said, if you're going to give a compliment, give a compliment. If you're consistent in this approach, if you ever compliment somebody, they're going to wonder, what's coming next? They said, just give me the compliment. I'm not worried about the bologna between the sandwich. So, it's okay to give a good compliment without trying to get extra mileage out of it. However, let's be balanced. I would imagine that for most of us, the proper balance would be more compliments than what we're doing and less scolding than what we're doing. In fact, I think if we feed the compliment side, the scolding side will not be needed as much. The amount of work and play, routine with variety. Here again, if we major on variety, we totally kill the routine. It's gone. Students don't know what to expect. What destroys the loving part of this loving firmness? Here's what I think destroys the loving part. This is what destroys the velvet around the iron hand. Anger. Your tone of voice. The expression on your face. When they can feel the heat coming from you. When they sense that you are personally reacting to their actions. Haste. Just grab them and whack them good. That idea. Public shame. There's nothing approachable about public shame. There's nothing warm. There's nothing soft and velvety about public shame. And I think if we use that method, we're taking the tenderness off of the touch. We can have the mentality, and students can actually feel this from us, that we are impossible to please. And that becomes a major issue for students. He's impossible to please. After a while, they forget to even try. I had a 9th grader or 10th grader who liked this girl in school. And as we know, that's not a good idea. And I tried to work with the situation, and he persisted in the liking this girl. And report card time came around, and I marked up his report card with justice. Send it home. His mother called, and I got from the son later that she really hit the ceiling when he brought his report card home. Anyhow, she talked to me about this. I don't even remember what she said, but I went to the student's desk, and I sat in his seat, and I tried to think about this, and I realized for the first time that it was impossible for him to please me. He was living in my disfavor because he was not performing the way I wanted him to. He was still not giving in to my wishes. He was not relinquishing his romance as a 10th grader. Therefore, nothing he did could please me. I sat there and I saw it from his perspective. That impossibility to please, it really takes the velvet right off of the iron hand. What destroys the firmness? The firmness is destroyed when you have a lackadaisical attitude as a teacher, as the one who maintains the order in the classroom. Oh well, you know, doesn't matter. Things are getting mushy. When you overlook wrong, students think if they can get by with something once, they might in fact be able to get by with it again, even if it's against the rule. They know it's against the rule. However, they saw somebody else getting by with it, they're going to try it too. Don't overlook wrong. Another thing that will soften the firmness is if you allow yourself to be talked out of what you know you ought to do. That destroys the firmness. Don't allow students to talk you out of what you know you ought to do. follow through with what you say. Don't fudge the boundaries. Well, okay, this time only. Don't be clear and concise. If you ever say, the next time this happens, make sure that's the last time you ever say that. That's permissible once. If you really feel that you need to give a fair warning once, say it one time only. Don't say that twice on the same issue. Inconsistency. The way that you deal with different students will take the firmness. It loosens your grip on the whole order and discipline situation in school. Be consistent. Pray for wisdom. Sometimes there are situations you do not know what to do. If you haven't been there yet, you're going to get there. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I had a situation. I thought sure this child was lying. All evidence pointed that this child was lying. This actually was one of my own. And I talked to her, and I tried to give her the opportunity to come on out with it. She refused, absolutely refused. I was down to this. I knew I did not know what to do. I was down to the point of, okay, I have two options. I can spank her. Worst case scenario is that she did not deserve it. The other issue is she can lie about it and get by scot-free. Those were the two options. That was the only thing that I had left. I prayed about this thing. I spanked her. I figured that it was probably worse for her to be able to lie about it and get by than to get spanked for something she really didn't do. After the spanking was all over, she confessed it. I attribute that to God. There are going to be situations you don't know what to do. And it's in those situations that I think you really need to lean hard on God and gain His insight, since He knows it all anyhow. Sometimes love doesn't look like love. Sometimes a refusal doesn't look like doing it. It doesn't look like what is the most loving thing to do, but really it is. Sometimes love carries a big stick, as one of our presidents, I think it was Theodore Roosevelt, said. Be firm. Be loving. I'd like to look at two examples of Jesus. John chapter 8, you know the story. This woman was taken in adultery, was caught in the very act. It was probably a setup. She was brought to Jesus. And according to the law, the Jewish law, she should have been stoned. They had the case was made against her. They had the evidence. Jesus, in his being full of grace and truth, looked on the situation, and he, you know the story, he showed the people who were accusing her that they were not as innocent as they may have thought. They left. The case against her was dropped. She found in him the softness. She found in him the refuge of being able to come to him and be in his presence. She certainly felt the softness of his grace. Jesus looked up at her and he said, "Woman, where are thine accusers?" It was obvious they were gone. He said, "Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more." This was the firmness. This was the iron hand. This was the justice of God. This was the truth of God. She felt them both. She went away from those last words probably ringing in her ears, in her mind. I don't know how that she could have forgotten. She's on death row. Jesus says, I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more. Jesus was not overlooking any wrong. Jesus was calling her to a higher standard of truth, the standard of holiness. At the same time, he was extending his grace and his pardon, his forgiveness to her. John 21 tells us of the time after the resurrection of Jesus, when Jesus came back onto the scene with his disciples. He was eating with them. We don't read anything at all that Peter ever came to Jesus and apologized to him for denying him, even cursing and swearing that he never knew him. We read of no apology on Peter's part whatsoever. I can well imagine that he felt that guilt, that niggling guilt within him that stayed with him. That guilt that, I wonder, did Jesus notice? Does he know? Did he look down and did he hear me? Jesus knew the turmoil in his heart, just like you know the turmoil in your students' hearts sometimes when you know that they have done wrong. Jesus was not willing to leave Peter with that guilt, in the same way that you should not be willing to leave your students with guilt on their consciences. It is a great loving act for you to free the conscience of your students. Jesus said, Peter, do you love me? Peter said, yes. And I don't know really how long it was. I wouldn't be surprised. It may have been about as long. How long it was that Jesus asked the next question, I would suppose it may have been about as long as it was in the first and second time that Peter denied Jesus. Jesus looked at Peter again. Peter, do you love me? Peter said, yes, I do. You know I do. Jesus waited a little while longer. Peter, do you love me? Then he gave him something to do. This was the restoration of Peter. This was Jesus bringing Peter into fellowship with him again. This was Jesus freeing Peter's conscience. This was Jesus allowing Peter to once again feel the closeness and the tenderness of Jesus outside of the guilt that he faced. I'd encourage you, teachers, exercise loving firmness. I'd encourage you, to the best of your ability, to the best of the ability with God's enabling grace, to be full of grace and truth. God bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.